Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Speaking to you today from a gorgeous yoga studio overlooking the Florida Bay. And we're joined by a very, very special guest, very powerful man. I won't even begin to give you his bio. I'm going to let him describe himself. Dr. Chris Busby speaking to us, I believe, from Riga, Latvia. Chris, are you with us?
Yes, hello.
Hi, Chris. How are you? This is Harvey Wasserman with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're honored to have you on. We're going to give you the full hour today to discuss the horrifying news from Fukushima and the debate over the green power of radiation and so much else that has been plaguing our airwaves and our planet for so long. Dr. Busby, if you would, could you tell, I've got your bio, but I prefer to have my guests, who have such a long bio, describe themselves. Could you give us your credentials in the order in which you would like us to have them?
My credentials? Well, I studied the health effects. I mean, this is my thing, really, is the health effects of low-level radiation and really the health effects of internal radiation, which I've been studying since about 1990, I suppose. And I've carried out a number of different epidemiological studies, and I've carried out a number of studies involving measurements in the field in Iraq and in Kosovo looking at uranium. And also I've developed a number of theoretical models which show that certain internal radionuclides don't really function in the way that they are modeled by the International Commission on Radiological Protection and all the other risk agencies that we have at the moment, you know, the United Nations and the Biological Effects Committee in the United States and so forth, who model radiation as if it was something that you can look at in terms purely of energy transferred into living tissue. I was a visiting professor at the University of Ulster for some years, and before that at the University of Liverpool, and now I'm at the Jacobs University in Bremen. And since 1998, I've been the scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk, which is an independent outfit which has a number of quite eminent radiation scientists in it, including Professor Yablokov and Dr. Alice Stewart and Professor Rosalie Bertel. A lot of the people that you know have raised the question of the health effects of internal radiation and the health effects of low-level radiation anyway for many, many years.
Yes, and your material on Chernobyl and on Fukushima has been absolutely essential to the discussion of the health effects of the two major disasters. But before we get into them, you mentioned that you have been studying the effects of uranium poisoning in Yugoslavia and in Iraq. And could you tell us a bit about that? Because that's something I'll lose track of if we don't deal with it at the top of the hour.
Yeah, sure. Well, uranium really has become a kind of invisible hazard. When people talk about the releases from nuclear power stations or atomic weapons or in the past, they were always categorized in terms of cesium-137 or sometimes strontium-90 or a whole range of quite highly radioactive short half-life or moderate half-life radionuclides, 30-year half-life radionuclides. And uranium is a very, very weakly radioactive substance, and also because it's natural, it's been classified generally in people's minds, I suppose, certainly in the way in which the nuclear industry and the military sell it, as relatively harmless. Of course, the problem is it's not harmless. And my work, which began in the 90s looking at the Gulf War syndrome, as a matter of interest, because it seemed to me that the sorts of things that were being described in Iraq, increases in childhood leukemia and so forth, were very likely to be the consequences of some sort of radiation exposure, and we didn't have to look far to find out what that was, because they, in the first Gulf War, the United States, well, the Allies anyway, used 350 tons or so of depleted uranium weaponry, and it was quite easy to figure out that these weapons worked by burning their way through tanks with an anti-tank weapon and creating an enormous cloud of nanoparticles of uranium oxide. And it seemed to me that if we started to look at the way in which these uranium particles function inside the body, of course they could be inhaled, and we also discovered by looking at air filters in the United Kingdom that they could travel very, very large distances. I mean, in 2006, we examined the air filter data from the Atomic Weapons Establishment at Aldermaston in Berkshire. We were able to show quite clearly that there was a sharp increase in the concentration of uranium in the filters as far away as England. So these nanoparticles function rather like a gas. Anyway, the point about uranium that emerged eventually after some research in the laboratory and also in the field, looking at the epidemiology of people who were exposed, we figured out that the problem with uranium is that it binds to DNA. This is the first thing and this is not a new discovery. This has been known since the 1960s. When it started to be used as an electron microscope stain. So UR acetate can be used to stain tissue, and it goes to the DNA, so it stains up the DNA quite well. And, of course, because it's got a very high atomic number, it's quite opaque to electrons. So when you use an electron microscope, it sort of sticks out like a sore thumb. Anyway, the problem is not only that it binds to DNA, and of course DNA is the target for all radiation-induced effects, you know, all the cancer and genetic damage and childhood health problems, you know, birth defects and so forth. But also, uranium, because it has a very high atomic number, it collects much more background radiation, much more gamma radiation. The absorption of gamma radiation, see, normally if you're walking about in the field, background radiation, background gamma radiation from the ground and so forth, cosmic rays and so forth, they just go through you. Most of it goes through you. Some of it's absorbed, and then that gives you your absorbed dose. But it's absorbed on the basis that your body's made of water, mainly. I mean, we're mostly water. And in fact, we don't contain many elements which are a high atomic number, which are sort of opaque to radiation. And I mean, an example, for instance, would be lead. Lead stops radiation. But, of course, uranium stops radiation much more than lead because it's got a higher atomic number. It turns out the atomic number is proportional to the fifth power of the atomic number. So that's the atomic number multiplied by itself five times is the function that decides how much radiation is absorbed. So not only have you got this stuff stuck to the DNA, chemical affinity, but you've also got it intercepting all the gamma radiation from natural background, which then focuses that background radiation into the DNA as photoelectrons, as little fast electrons, which smash the DNA up. And so once you figure that out,
Dr. Busby, the reality is then that when the uranium that is released into the atmosphere and the land as I suppose a form of powder, and is then ingested by people in places like Iraq and Yugoslavia, where uranium-based weapons were used. This is now having a noticeable health effect on the people in the area. Is that correct?
Well, yes, we did a couple of studies, or three studies, in fact, in Fallujah, which showed a big increase in congenital malformation in the children. And then we looked at the uranium in the hair of the mothers of the children. And we found mothers who had very long hair. We actually looked for mothers that had very long hair, because what happens is you excrete the elements into the hair as the hair grows. So in other words, a lock of hair, a strand of hair, which is long, is a sort of an archaeological level of different things that have happened in the past. Now, you can use it as a historic determination of what's happened in the past. And we found uranium in the hair of the mothers. But also in the other study that we did, we found enormously high levels of cancer. I mean, truly enormously high levels, higher than the other that were reported after the Hiroshima bomb. And of course, the levels of radiation after the Hiroshima bomb were very, very high. And the levels of radiation from the kind of levels of uranium that were released in terms of conventional dosimetry were very, very low. So it seemed to us that what we have discovered there is that uranium seems to be the main problem. Uranium seems to have a multiplied hazard, in fact, we worked out, of about 1,000 to 10,000 times. So in other words, if you take a dose from the uranium on the basis of the inhalation of the uranium, multiply it by 1,000 to 10,000, you get roughly the right number of cancers. It's truly quite extraordinary. Anyway, of course, as usual, you can't get this stuff published, because as soon as you try and get it published in the literature, it becomes very, very difficult. It gets blocked, and then people write to the journals, and they say that this is impossible because the dose is too low, and blah, blah, blah. So it's been all of my work in this whole area of radiation health effects has been an enormously difficult struggle against the scientific community that is funded by the military and by the nuclear industry.
Yes, and
anyway, yes, that's right.
I want to make sure you know that we link many of your articles when we can at nukefree.org, nukefree.org. And of course, your uphill struggle to make clear the dangers of depleting uranium weapons has been noted, and there is a dialogue about it, frankly, thankfully, for where there wasn't before.
Yes. Now, I know I do have some fans, but the problem is it's a bit like Fukushima, really. The people who are in power seem to be able to ignore reality. So, and I mean, that's always been the case in all of the things that I've done. So I can rather like Galileo, you know, I can go and show them the moons of Jupiter, and they just say, well, they don't exist because they can't exist because our theory says it's impossible. So we are in this kind of crazy, sort of bizarre Frank Zappa type situation now. Well, in fact, it's become even more bizarre with Fukushima now, because they're now going to make it illegal to tell the truth about it.
Well, let's jump into that in a minute. I do want to, before we leave depleted uranium, make it clear, as you have, that the depleted uranium from the weapons used by the United States and the Allies in Yugoslavia and in Iraq is going to be with them for a long, long time, as will the health effects. Is that not true?
I think we're winning that one slowly. It is slowly, though. I think we are winning that one. And I think ultimately we'll win the other one in terms of the science. But whether we will be able to win it in terms of politics, I think it's getting to the point now where there's a sort of Sovietization, if I can call it that, of reality, you know, where we can make real what's always been hidden, but then it can just be ignored by the powerful, and that does seem to be the way in which we're going now. It's really getting a bit out of control.
All right, so let's talk about that now. You have been doing much of the pioneering work on the potential and tangible health effects of Fukushima. You just briefly mentioned the State Secrets Act. So can you tell us about the State Secrets Act that's now come to be in Japan and how it will affect the flow of information around Fukushima?
Well, the thing is, my thing is the health effects, okay? So I followed the engineering, if you like to put it that way, you know, being able to see that what all along, right from the beginning, in fact, you know, almost on the first day, I was on the BBC saying that this was as bad as Chernobyl, maybe worse, because of the huge numbers of people involved. And in fact, in terms of the amounts of radiation also, really quite comparable at Chernobyl. And of course, at that time, everybody was saying, you know, all the nuclear industry scientists were being wheeled out one after another to say that it wasn't even as bad as Three Mile Island. All along, I've consistently argued or shown, if you like, and demonstrated that the people who are in charge in Japan, but also in the International Atomic Energy Agency and the World Health Organization and in the United Nations, have all been coming out with what can only be described as just lies and cover-ups, continually doing this. And I mean, ultimately, I would say that these people should be put in court and called, you know, brought to justice. Because in a sense, this is a war. You know, what we have here is scientific dishonesty, which is resulting in the deaths of people. So, I mean, I did calculate the number of cancers that would be likely on the basis of the model, risk model of the European Committee of Radiation Risk. And there were a lot. There were about 40,000 cancers, as I recall, in the 200-kilometer radius. And since then, I've been doing some studies of Tokyo itself, which suggests that the problem is further south as well. And of course, Tokyo has this monstrously large population. And you may have seen also that what I started to do was to look at air filters from cars and air filters from air conditioning systems. So this is real data. I mean, the people from Japan sent me all this stuff. They sent me the filters and so on, and I measured the radiation in various laboratories and using various techniques. And a lot of the stuff I stuck on the internet, I stuck it on YouTube and so on. So it's really quite real. These people have been exposed to very high levels of radiation, which are going to cause enormously high levels of ill health. And we know that because we know what happened after Chernobyl. So, my colleague Yuri Bendashevsky gave a presentation in the European Committee on Radiation Risk Conference, and we published that as a book called Fukushima, What to Expect. And we know what's going to happen. There are going to be increases in cancer, but mainly also there are going to be increases in heart attacks and strokes. People are going to suddenly fall down dead. Children are going to have heart problems, arrhythmias, and they'll have heart attacks, and their stomachs will be like the stomachs of old people. It's all quite horrifying. It's going to be like Belarus. You're going to get a reduction in the birth rate and an increase in the death rate. And ultimately, there's going to be a failure of the population to exist. Because that's what happens. Once you get beyond a certain level of replacement, then there's no more people. And yet, they're allowing people to live in those areas, and they're saying, oh, well, you know, the dose is not high enough for it to harm you. And it's just, I mean, what can I say? You know, the problem really, Harvey, is that it's a political problem. And what Fukushima has done is it's made real what is a political problem actually in all of the Western countries. It's the same political problem. It's just that it hasn't manifested itself in the other countries because there hasn't been a Fukushima for it to have to manifest itself.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Chris Busby, one of the world's leading experts on the impacts of radiation and health, and one of the few people from the scientific community has come forward to speak about the dangers of what's happening at Fukushima. Let's back up just a few seconds here, Chris, or a few years, I suppose, 27, and talk about Chernobyl. We've had a quarter century now to see the health impacts of Chernobyl. We still have a massive official denial. As you know, and many of our listeners know, there's been a study showing upwards of 1 million likely deaths as a result of radiation release from Chernobyl. Can you tell us a bit, please, about your experiences with the studies on the impacts of Chernobyl and what you believe to be true, what has happened to human health as a result of Chernobyl?
Yes, I can't hear you terribly well. You want me to talk about the health effects of Chernobyl, yes?
Please. And what do you know to be true about what's happened there?
Okay. Well, the point about Chernobyl is that a lot of the data at the beginning wasn't available because of the Soviets. And a lot of it was covered up. I mean, actually, people, they're a bit like Japan at the moment. You know, they're talking about cancer data and leukemia data. And it was actually classified as secret. But then what you can do is you can go along afterwards and you can compare the health effects, the health indicators of people in different areas of contamination. And that's a very good epidemiological approach for dealing with this sort of thing. And of course, to some extent, it relies upon the idea that if you get double the dose, you get double the effect. And unfortunately, that isn't the case. What happens is that the lower the dose, you get proportionally greater an effect. But if you take that sort of linear approximation, Professor Yablokov has used all sorts of data which is in the Russian language and which, of course, wasn't translated or dealt with by the scientists in the West who were working for the nuclear industry or who were associated with UNSCEAR. United Nations, that is, or the International Atomic Energy Agency. And he's compared various different areas and calculated that the death toll is in excess of a million. I myself did a similar sort of calculation based on the ECRR, the European Committee on Radiation Risk model. Now that model is came out with an answer of 1,400,000. So it's not entirely different. It's a bit higher than Professor Yablokov, and it also is only for cancers. So I think probably he's erring on the side of caution, really. I think the true answer is much worse. I mean, for example, in Sweden, in Tondal, this is a long way away from Chernobyl. You know, these are effects in northern Sweden where the doses were really quite modest. The contamination from cesium-137, he was able to show that there was an 11% increase in cancer for every 100 kilobecquerels per square meter. Well, if you transfer that across to Fukushima, where there were probably 300 kilobecquerels per square meter of cesium, you're going to get about a 33% increase in cancer over that same area. So the answer to your question is that the effects of Chernobyl are very, very serious, and they don't stop now. They don't stop with the people who are exposed, because we know from work that's been done on rodents, on the particular kinds of various mammals that were studied in the Chernobyl area where the contamination was, that there are transgenerational effects, what's now called genomic instability. And this is quite well documented. Lots of work's been done on this now, because they can now measure this stuff in the genetic tests, and they've been able to show that these genetic effects continue for at least 22 generations. So we've got a situation at Chernobyl where people who are exposed will pass a signal to their children, and their children will pass to the grandchildren, and so on. And interestingly, talking about uranium, which I was, we found exactly the same effect when we did it. This is me now, I say we. I did a study of the atomic test veteran. These are the guys who went out and exploded the nuclear bombs in Christmas Island and the Marshall Islands and so on. And those I looked at the children and the grandchildren. They also showed the same levels of effect. There's an nine-fold increase in congenital malformation in the test veteran's children, and the nine-fold in the grandchildren. So it's the same. It doesn't reduce. And this is the problem with Chernobyl, too. Once you poison the population with radiation, it goes on forever, or certainly for a very long time.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Chris Busby about the unhappy effects of Chernobyl. Three Mile Island, Dr. Busby, have you looked into Three Mile Island at all? I'm curious about that.
Well, I know that Steve Wing looked at Three Mile Island, and he did some epidemiological study of Three Mile Island. No, I haven't really concerned myself with Three Mile Island. I'll tell you what my thing is. My thing is to look at the sea. Now, in terms of epidemiology, what I've done is looked at contaminated seas. So I've looked at the Irish Sea. Then I've done a very big study of the Irish Sea using cancer registry data down to small areas. So in other words, what you can do is you can look at cancer rates very close to the sea and then a little bit further away and then a little bit further away, right the way, you know, inland, and see what happens. And you can also do this in the Baltic Sea. Now, both the Baltic Sea and the Irish Sea have been highly contaminated. The Baltics, where I live now in Latvia, it was contaminated from the weapons test fallout and also from Chernobyl. And the Irish Sea was contaminated because of a nuclear reprocessing plant there called Sellafield, which in the 80s was permitted by the British government to just pump enormous amounts of radionuclides into the Irish Sea, which has got quite a local circulation. So what we found is that there was an enormously sharp increase in cancer very, very close to the sea. So within the first kilometre from the sea, right in that zone, you get a sharp increase in cancer. And the reason for that is because these radionuclides end up in the sediment on the beaches, and then they get resuspended and blown inland. But they drop out quite fast. So again, it's like the uranium particles in the Gulf War areas in Iraq and Kosovo. But here what you're doing is you're producing particles of plutonium and uranium and other radionuclides quite close to the littoral, quite close to the coast, and people are inhaling them. And in fact, we know that's the case because studies have been done in autopsy specimens where they've actually measured this stuff. And you can see that the plutonium increases sharply as you get very close to the coast. Now, this is certainly going to happen in Fukushima, all along the coast of Japan. even right to the south of Tokyo, people who live very close to the coast are going to suffer some serious, serious health effects as a result of this, these releases to the ocean that are continuing still. But anyway, certainly at the time, were quite profound.
Well, that's terrifying. We're talking with Dr. Chris Busby, one of the world's leading experts on the impacts of radiation and health. We've been talking about Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and now Fukushima. Dr. Busby, we understand that radiation has been detected off the coast of Alaska from Fukushima. When can we start to expect to see this along the rest of the West Coast, down Canada, through the United States and Mexico, and what kinds of effects would you expect to see as a result of this?
Yes. Okay, well, I mean, I've heard an awful lot from various people about how it's going to be the end of the world if there's a total catastrophe at Fukushima. But the fact is that the Pacific Ocean, I mean, I've made myself a bit unpopular in this area, incidentally, because I haven't agreed with the doom and gloom, total doom scenario. I mean, I'm not saying it's great, you know, but the fact is that you've got a fair bit of dilution occurring by the time the radioactivity comes all the way from Japan to the United States. And you're going to get effects along the coast there, and you'll get some effects like those effects that I've been talking in the Irish Sea and the Baltic Sea. But so far, the concentrations of radionuclides that I've seen in the fish that have been reported, measurements in tuna and various other sea fish, have not been anything like as high as are measured in the Irish Sea and in the Baltic Sea. So if you want to know what's going to happen in America, then you should look to areas where the same thing has happened before. And we kind of know what that is because we've studied it. So we know what's happening in the Baltic Sea. We know what's happening in the Irish Sea. And the concentrations along the coast of the United States are not as high as that. Now, of course, they're going to have an effect. There's no doubt about that. I mean, recently we actually, Joe Mangano and Janet Sherman and I, we found effects in children in California at teeny-weeny levels of radioiodine, you know, almost vanishing levels. So certainly very, very low levels of radiation do have an effect. And, of course, the other problem is that these radionuclides are not properly characterized in terms of their concentration. They're better characterized in terms of their particle size. So if you get radionuclide particles fetching up on the coast of the United States, then there will be resuspension, and then people living near the sea will get an increased risk of cancer. But I don't think it's a case of everybody, you know, running away from it and saying, oh, my goodness, we're all going to die. It's not as bad as that at the moment. And even actually, if the whole thing went up, it wouldn't be as bad as people say. And the reason for that is we know what if you take the total concentration of material in Fukushima, the total quantity, rather, it actually produces an injection into the world environment of probably about half the amount that was injected into the world environment over the period of atmospheric weapons testing. But it won't go up in the air quite the same as the atmospheric weapons testing stuff, so it won't be so universally distributed. It'll be more locally distributed, so it will wipe out Japan, in my opinion. But even if it all went into the Pacific, it would probably cause quite an impact on sea life. Yes, it would have effects on the development of the fish, the invertebrates that the fish eat, and so there would be a fairly catastrophic collapse in biological life in the Pacific. But you know, it's kind of more of the same, Harvey. You know, like we've had this since 1952. It's been getting more and more and more and more and more, you know. And so Fukushima, I mean, everybody's excited about it because it's happening and it's real and it's there and it's in the news and all this stuff. But actually, some terrible things have happened in the past. Between 1959 and 1963, huge quantities of radionuclides were injected into the atmosphere. And the result of that was the cancer epidemic, the actual cancer epidemic that we see that started in 1980, that everybody knows about. And, of course, you know, in areas where there were higher levels of radionuclides, like, for instance, Marin County, you know, which in California, which takes a runoff from the Rockies, which had all the radionuclides from the Nevada tests, has very, very high levels of breast cancer. So this has happened before. And what we ought to be doing is banging the drum about the whole business right back from the beginning, and not just getting too excited about Fukushima. Fukushima is like the flag that should end it all, in my opinion.
We're talking with Dr. Chris Busby. We're going to take a short break. Chris, I hope you'll stay with us, please, for the next half hour. There's quite a bit to talk about. This is a serious discussion that's going on worldwide about Fukushima. You're one of the very, very few to step forward and talk about these health effects. And I do want to revert a little bit to 3 Mile Island when we come back. We'll take about a three-minute break now with Dana Ryan singing the solo talk song. We'll be back with Dr. Chris Busby talking us from Europe.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
Yes, indeed. Lots of forest for the bears. This is Harvey Wasserman back with another half of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're speaking with Dr. Chris Busby from Europe. And by the way, I'm speaking to you from a gorgeous yoga studio in South Florida overlooking the Florida Bay. However, it does have quite an echo. I put a blanket over my head to kind of dim the effects. Some things you can never count on, you know, and life is full of surprises. But I think we're doing all right here. Dr. Busby, can you hear me well enough?
I can hear you, but you do seem to be echoing about a bit, like you say, yeah.
Yeah, so, I might have to ask you
to repeat sometime.
Yeah, I'm sitting here in this yoga studio with a blanket over my head, so we're doing the best we can. Most beautiful place on earth to do a radio show from, but you never know what you're expected is going to be. Dr. Busby, I want to talk to you a bit. I went into central Pennsylvania in the year after the accident at 3 Mile Island. I interviewed many dozens of people and was absolutely horrified to find the health effects from, you know, doses of radiation that the utility company said would have no impact whatsoever. In particular, they said that the radiation from 3 Mile Island would be the equivalent of a chest x-ray to the entire population, neglecting to tell us, of course, that Dr. Alice Stewart had linked a single x-ray to pregnant women to a doubled childhood leukemia rate. And I would assume that this is the kind of thing we're going to be looking at from Fukushima, as we've certainly seen at Chernobyl as well. Would that be correct?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the real problem, and this is the most important message that I have for the planet, actually, is that when we talk about doses and we compare x-rays to people with doses from radioactive particles or internal radionuclides or uranium or whatever inside the body, you cannot use the quantity or dose to measure the radiation. It's meaningless. And the reason for that is because dose represents energy per unit mass. So if you sit in front of a fire and you warm yourself, you get a certain amount of energy, and you divide that into the whole of the body mass, and it gives you your dose. This is actually exactly how they do it, in fact, except that it's not heat energy from a fire, it's radiation energy that's absorbed. But you can also reach into the fire and you can eat a hot coal. And of course, and in terms of dose, that's precisely the same dose. Now this is the essential problem. So what happens is that you can get a dose, for example, from Chernobyl, which can be categorized as 2 millisieverts, say, for example. This is how they measure dose in millisieverts. And somebody will tell you that 2 millisieverts is the same as getting natural background for a year. But of course, but the problem is if you get too many, if you're too many sieverts is all in one place, it's not too many sieverts. It's very many more sieverts. For instance, a single alpha particle track through a cell, so internal radionuclides now, uranium or plutonium, they produce alpha particles, and alpha particles are quite short-range, highly ionizing particles. They're positively charged. And they create a dose, if you like to see it as a dose, to the cell of in excess of 500 millisieverts. So you can't use this business of dose to describe internal radiation. Now, as far as Alice Stewart's work was concerned, what she showed was that a dose of about 10 millisieverts to the fetus caused a 40% increased chance of cancer in the child once it had been born. But the reason that was the case is because the fetus is extraordinarily sensitive to radiation. It's very, very small, and the cells are replicating very rapidly, and replicating cells are much more likely to take on genetic damage and be damaged. So what happened there, of course, is that she discovered that if you X-ray the fetus, you get an increase in cancer. But what we're talking about in Fukushima is we're talking about the categorization of dose by the International Atomic Energy Agency or by the authorities in Fukushima or by the United Nations or the nuclear industry or whoever. And their categorization of dose in terms of millisieverts invites us to compare that with X-rays or with CAT scans or with external radiation, where the actual dose to each individual cell is really quite small because it's diluted over the whole body, you see. But in reality, that isn't what is happening. What's really happening is that if there's 2 millisieverts on your Geiger counter, it means that there's lots and lots and lots of these little radioactive particles, like little sparkly kind of hot sort of sparks floating about in the air. Of course, you can't see them, but if you could detect radiation, you would see them. It would be like everything would be glittering. And you would be inhaling this glittering dust. And each little bit of glitter, when it got into your lungs or was translocated to your lymphatic system or ended up in your breast as a result of that, you know, going in through the bloodstream, through the lungs, it would then produce an enormously high dose at the point of the glitter, you see. And so this cannot be compared to flying in an aeroplane from Los Angeles to London or eating, you know, bananas, which are like, you know, which give a uniform dose over the whole body because potassium is uniformly distributed in the body. So you have to be very, very careful that radiation is not something that you can describe in a way that covers every single type of exposure. And these internal exposures, particularly to substances like strontium and uranium, which bind to DNA, are fantastically dangerous, like hundreds to thousands of times more dangerous than would be considered on the basis of their dose. Because what the nuclear industry does, they just take the energy from the decay of the strontium and they dilute it into the whole body. And, of course, it's very, very, very small. And they then say, oh, well, this can't hurt you because it's much less than you would get, whatever, you know, if you flew to America or if you eat a Brazil nut or whatever it is. It's just nonsense. It's just nonsense.
And it's part of the nonsense, of course, is very political. Can you tell us, you know, when we discuss these issues publicly, we always have the International Atomic Energy Agency and World Health Organization thrown up at us, and they, of course, always give a carte blanche, a clean slate to the nuclear industry. As someone who's dealt with them for so many years, can you tell us the politics of the IAEA and the World Health Organization when it comes to nuclear power and radiation?
Well, the World Health Organization signed an agreement with the IAEA. They're both agencies of the United Nations, and the International Atomic Energy Agency was set up to regulate the control of nuclear materials, particularly uranium, in the 50s when all the bombs were being made. But then we had the Atoms for Peace. And they were given a kind of fig leaf, as it were, to regulate the development or to encourage the development of nuclear energy, which at that time was sold on the basis that it would be energy too cheap to be metered. But at the same time, what was happening was that there was a lot of military interest in manufacturing bombs, and there were huge tests nuclear tests being carried out in the Marshall Islands and in Australia by the British, and then also Christmas Island and in the United States as well, and in Russia, and then later on, of course, China and so forth. So it was necessary to reassure the public that the radionuclide fallout from these tests, which was getting into people, and was getting into the milk, and it was getting into all the food and everything around about the 60s when the tests were really going mad, to reassure people that these exposures were harmless. And so what happened was that the International Atomic Energy Agency then signed an agreement with the WHO. And of course, the doctors by this time were beginning to get a bit shirty about all this. They really were beginning to, I mean, if you look at the data, if you look at the letters that were being written, the doctors, the WHO people, were thinking that this was causing problems. And in fact, it was. There was an increase in infant mortality right about the time of it for the weapons testing. So they had to be shut up. So they had this agreement between the WHO and the IAEA that the WHO were not going to do any research on the radiation, on the effects of radiation on human health. And that's still in situ, that agreement. It's still there. And so the WHO doesn't do anything. So there's a kind of moratorium on research on radiation and health. The only people who do it are people like me, you know, who've got no money and nobody can actually attack them because they don't have any way in which they can get at them. So there are a few people that do it, but most of the researchers can't do it because they just immediately get sacked.
The public people tend to trot out studies about Chernobyl, allegedly from the World Health Organization, that say there were no problems there.
I was in Kiev. I actually was invited by there was a big World Health Organization conference in Kiev in 2000, and I had just done a study in which we looked at infant leukemia, that leukemia in the first year of life. And there were four or five different studies that had been carried out after Chernobyl that showed that the children who were in the womb at the time of Chernobyl had a significant excess risk of leukemia. So anyway, I was invited to go along by some Russians, in fact, to go along and give this paper in Kiev. And I met these people who were the heads of the United Nations and the International Atomic Energy Agency, who were saying that there were no provable effects following Chernobyl. They were there up on the stage talking about this stuff. And they were being screamed at by the audience. There were all these women doctors, mainly, who had been working in the areas of contamination, who were shouting and yelling from the audience and saying, who paid you to say these things and so on. It was really quite a jamboree, really. And it was filmed by a bloke called Jerkoff. And so that's actually on YouTube now. It's called Atomic Lies or Nuclear Controversies or something like that. He made a really good Swiss film. So I think anybody who wants to know what's really going on, they can watch that film and see that video and see it going on. But the point about this is that these heads of UNSCEAR and WHO and so on, the people who are like the figureheads, the so-called scientific experts, if you look into what they've done, you find they haven't published anything at all. They're just people who are apparatchik. They've just been absorbed into the system, and they've just spouted nonsense about how radiation is harmless. They actually haven't done any studies at all. If you take the head of the IAEA, a bloke called Abel Gonzalez, I mean, his first degree, his PhD is in some kind of optics. And if you look to see what papers he's published absolutely nothing. He's done no studies, whatever. So, I mean, these are the people who are telling us that radiation is harmless, and they wouldn't know because they haven't done anything on it. They haven't done any studies on it. And any publications that they do have, they just ignore it. They ignore all the studies that show there's a problem and then just plot out the studies that don't. And basically, the main study which shows that the radiation, which underpins the risk model, is the Japanese A-bomb study, which is about external radiation and not about internal radiation. So it's worthless as far as we're concerned when we're looking at Fukushima and Chernobyl and those sorts of internal radionuclide exposures.
We're speaking with Dr. Chris Busby. Dr. Chris Busby is talking to us from Europe. He's one of the world's leading experts on the health effects of radiation. has done, and among the very few who has done studies of Chernobyl that are credible and outside the nuclear industry, and we're talking about Fukushima here, and you have specialized, Dr. Busby, in the effects of, on bodies of water, of massive radiation releases, and especially the Baltic and the Irish Sea. What can we expect, would you say, in the Pacific, as a result of the 300 tons of radioactive water that are pouring in every day and all the other impacts, assuming, of course, that an accident does get even worse than it already has, what would you think we'll be seeing in the future in the Pacific as a result of Fukushima?
Well, in a sense, the levels of radionuclides coming out of Fukushima, this has already happened. The Marshall Islands nuclear tests by the United States between 1952 and 1958 produced considerably more radionuclide contamination into the Pacific than we've had so far from Fukushima. And of course, it had various effects. The tuna was very radioactive. The tuna, when it was landed in Japan, had to be buried. I mean, you could actually measure it with Geiger counters. It wasn't a question of looking to see in the laboratory how many becquerels per kilogram there were. The actual fish were hot. So this has happened before, and the Pacific has, I suppose, you would have to say that it's recovered. And I'm not sure that what's happened so far in Fukushima is any worse than that. Of course, you know, this was in the southern hemisphere, but now you've got stuff coming which will go north from Japan, and then it will come down the coast of the United States. So there will be contamination on the coast of the United States, and the places to watch out for are places where you have river entries and beaches which are muddy rather than sandy, because this material contaminates the fine particles, and of course the fish will be slightly radioactive, and because they will be eating all the invertebrates which have become slightly radioactive, so it will be a sort of messy development along the lines of all the other messy developments involving radiation which have occurred since 1952. I don't think that you need to worry that people are going to just all suddenly get, you know, very, very ill. It's going to be some kind of dreadful catastrophe. I don't think it is. I mean, I know a lot of people do, but I have to say, on the basis of the studies I've done of areas which are more likely to be more contaminated than California and Washington and Alaska and so on are going to become, I don't think it's going to be as bad as all that. I mean, I have to say that's my position on it. It's not as dreadful as everybody's going to say. But of course, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's something that I have overlooked, or some particular kind of movement of water that will produce a higher concentration there than you would expect. But even so, it would have to get pretty big to get to the level of the Baltic Sea. And the Baltic Sea has got 50,000 becquerels to 100,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium in the silt of Finland and Estonia and Latvia and Sweden. And there are huge amounts of strontium 90 in the sediment of Sweden and Finland and so on. Much, much higher than you would ever expect to get, I think, anywhere near the United States, although not as high as it's going to be on the coast of Japan, that's for sure.
Well, what do you expect off the coast of Japan? What kinds of things do you think you'll see, and will it have a health impact on the people in Japan?
I think the health effects on the coast of Japan are going to be pretty catastrophic. And the thing to look out for, too, and this is a very important point that needs to be made, is that traditionally, I mean, or at least even now, too, people are categorizing the health effects in terms of cancers and leukemias. But actually, what we have discovered from Chernobyl is that in fact, the health effects are across the board. So what you will have is a uniform increase in all of the attributes of aging, if you like. So every single disease that exists will increase its incidence or its prevalence as a result of radiation, because radiation affects the body uniformly. It affects all the cells of the body. It destroys them. It mutates them. And so you will get heart attacks. You will get increases in strokes. You will get decrease in fertility. you get an increase in congenital malformations, you get an increase in perinatal mortality. In fact, there is already, I have already started to study this in Japan, and I have already found increases in perinatal mortality. And that's going to be a paper which I should be publishing sometime next year, but I won't say too much about it now. So these effects are going to be found. You're going to get a reduction in the birth rate and an increase in the death rate. And of course, you know, that means, as I said before, like there are going to be fewer children and more dead people. So ultimately, there's not going to be a population there. Because that's what happens. If you start to destroy a population by killing the fetus, and this is what's happening, and also because the older people are then going to become unable, the sperms are going to be destroyed and the ova are going to be genetically mutated, so there's just going to be miscarriages or no fertility, then that's going to be the end of Japan. There won't be any people.
We're talking with Dr. Chris Busby. Dr. Busby, we only have about 7 minutes left. Can you give us your website and how people can see your work and contact you? I do post your work at www.nukefree.org, but yes. I know you have a struggle because of the opposition of the nuclear industry. So where do people go to support you and to see your work?
We have tried to develop various ways in which you can deal with this. And one way is to just tell people what we've done. And all the scientific papers and developments like that are on the Green Audit website. So that's www.greenaudits.org. That's just one word, Green Audits. And then the other one is the Low Level Radiation Campaign, which is www.llrc, the Low Level Radiation Campaign. And that's a very, very good website. That's the one that we have run since 1995, and it has everything that we've done on it. Now, as well as that, we have a website called nuclearjustice.org. Now, this is an interesting development. I was in Vilnius, Lithuania, about 2 to 3 years ago with Professor Bandashevsky, who you probably know is the guy who was banged up in jail after he found that these Chernobyl effects were occurring in Belarus. And we set up something called the International Committee for Nuclear Justice. And what this has done is it's developed the idea of human rights. So there are some very interesting and powerful human rights arguments against contaminating the environment with radionuclides. And they're all on this website, Nuclear Justice. So what we would like people to do there is to download the templates for petitions and to petition their governments and to petition anybody that they can petition on the basis of human rights. Because after all, you have a constitution in America which is high on human rights. Most countries have constitutions which are predicated on human rights. And, of course, there's the United Nations human rights, international human rights documents, all of these human rights documents that people pay lip service to that nobody does anything about. And, in fact, you can use these to argue that the contamination of the environment with radionuclides is a human rights issue.
Well, indeed it is, and since we're down to the last few minutes, you mentioned earlier in the show a study by Dr. Jeanette Sherman and Joe Mangano indicating health impacts from Fukushima in the United States. Can you tell us, as a scientist, what do you think might have caused this increase in mortality in the U.S., and how specifically are children more vulnerable?
Well, I think it's very likely that it's the radioiodine that's caused these effects, my opinion. And in fact, we found hypothyroidism effects in California babies, which we published recently. Radioiodine affects the development of the fetus. Because it's a gas, it gets quite quickly from Fukushima to the United States. Of course, there are various other gases as well, with radio xenons and so on. But I think it's the iodine which gets into the fetus and into the child.
Would you recommend that pregnant mothers with small children on the west coast of the United States and Alaska and Canada that they start taking iodine pills?
No, I don't think I think that's too late now. I think that they probably should have taken iodine pills at the time of the accident. But, it has a very short half-life, the iodine-131, which is the nuclide that we're talking about. and it's all gone now. Just excuse me while I open a bottle of champagne, okay? She says, don't open it.
We're down to our last 4 minutes. Unfortunately, of course, the accident at Fukushima is not quite over. So we have to take precautions as we go along. Dr. Chris Busby, it's been an honor and a pleasure. It's been an honor. I'm not sure how pleasurable it's been, but we have to deal with these realities, as you well know. What would be your final thing that you would tell our largely American audience here about Fukushima and the continuing operation of nuclear reactors?
Yes, well, two things. Firstly, don't be too worried. I mean, don't think that that you're going to die and everything is going to be, don't get too gloomy about it all. You're a very, very long way away from Japan, and there are going to be effects. But actually, the effects are probably more likely to be from some local nuclear power station to you. And this is what you should be looking on your doorstep, and you should be looking at your own government and your own nuclear reactors. As probably the greatest threat to you, a much greater threat than Fukushima. As far as Fukushima is concerned, I don't know quite what to say, what can be done about that. I don't have any solution. I think, as I said, it's like Frank Zappa said, that once it becomes obvious that the scenery isn't working, they take it away and you see the brick wall.
Well, we seem to have lost Dr. Busby, but we're just at the end here of the Saratoga Green Power and Wellness Show. I think he got a bottle of champagne. The news, of course, from Fukushima continues to be disturbing, and we are going to do our best to try and put that situation in the hands of the global community and see what we can do to at least get some international force into Fukushima and to the other nuclear plants around the world. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show with Harvey Wassman. I apologize for any echoes and muffling we've had on my part here. I've been talking to you from a beautiful yoga studio. I hope the next place I talk to you from is equally as beautiful, and that at the same time we have a little better sound quality, but nonetheless, thanks for sticking with us. This has been the Saratopia Green Power and Wellness Show. You have another hour. Thanks so much to the crew in New York, and we will see you next week in Saratopia.